I'm Joanne Wilson, and this is Positively Gotham Gal. Real, honest, and meaningful conversations with women entrepreneurs about their approach to life, business, and everything in between. Shanna Tellerman is the founder and CEO of Modsy, a design service that provides high-quality solutions to the pain points of home design. We got together over Zoom to discuss Shanna's entrepreneurial journey and the future of work in a post-COVID world.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
So where are you hanging at? Your home, obviously.
I'm home. I'm in my tiny little bungalow in San Francisco, in fact.
How is San Francisco?
You know, it just got better today because they apparently yesterday reversed the closure of the playgrounds. So, you know, they put us all back in lockdown again. And on Sunday, they closed all the playgrounds. But I guess all the parents and legislators like revolted. And so it was only closed for 2 days and then they reopened all the playgrounds. So
it's hard for these young kids. I mean, I was reading this article today and that this little two-year-old, like these people were coming towards them and the kid was like, oh, people.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's very weird. So our son's 2.5 now, which I can't believe, but
oh my God, we
went by the playground this morning and he said, playground closed, sad. And I was like, that's so depressing. Like never in my life has the playground been closed, but in your like sad little life, it's been closed for half of your life.
Oh my God. I mean, it really is so crazy.
Yeah, it's crazy. But I mean, on the other side, like he gets to see us all day, every day, like no commute. Yeah. Life is very like calm. It's really actually, I don't know, for as many hard things, there's been like all this wonderful stuff too.
Yeah, listen, with darkness comes silver linings, right? Yes. So there is certainly silver linings. But in the past, like couple days, I'd say everyone I talk to just sounds so, there's like this malaise, you know, you're like, hey, they're like, hi.
Yeah. You're like, I'm over this. Please get me over this winter.
And then I'm listening to the daily of how we gave up all these shots and you're just like, but we have tons. And so it's all slanted. And I'm like, I got to get off the Twitter situation.
Yeah. No more energy for this. Totally. Totally. Yeah. It's a good description of it. I'm like, I am very tired right now.
Yeah, I completely hear you. So, all right. So we're just going to get into it. We're going to chat away. Very excited to talk to you. And so, I mean, you're an entrepreneur through and through. What's the first thing you did that was entrepreneurial in your life?
Oh, that's a great question. It's actually a lemonade stand. How cliche. So I actually grew up right next to the Preakness racetrack in Baltimore, like a block away.
I did not know that. I used to go to the Preakness.
Oh, really?
My high school boyfriend, his father was like a huge guy in the horsing race.
Amazing. Well, then you've actually like gone to the Preakness. Yeah. I've never actually gone into the Preakness, even though I lived a block away because I was always too young. They didn't let me when I was living there. But so you know what it's like. I mean, it's like massive crowds. We have like all these people. And so one year we were like, we should make lemonade and brownies and sell them for like 5 cents or something like that. And we made a killing. We made like $40 selling 5 cent brownies and lemonade. And then like, it became a bigger thing. Like each year we like sold more, there were more kids from the block who came and there was no commercial stands anywhere. So all these drunk people would come out and they would have just like earned a bunch of money. So they'd give us all these like half dollars.
Yeah. I mean, what I remember like going to Jazz Fest, you know, as you're walking down those streets, anything you got to buy is from the homes that are on
the corner. There you go. So go back today and now there's like commercial carts everywhere. There's like, I mean, it's like a thriving business around it, but we were business number one.
That's awesome. So you ended up though going to a school that is so tech driven. And how was that there? It's like, was it gender balanced? Did you find your people that were also tech driven? I mean, you know, you're so warm and amiable and you've had done so many different things in your career. But meanwhile, you know, at the end of the day, like you have a serious tech brain.
Yeah. Yeah. I've always liked math and science and art. So I actually chose Carnegie Mellon because of art. So strangely, I went into their College of Fine Arts for oil painting. Like that was my major. And so a little bit, but I was just telling actually one of our designers yesterday that like all of my creative juices go into Modsy. Like it is a very creative, I think building businesses is very creative. And so I don't have like energy left at the end of the day to go paint. And for me, painting takes like creative energy. It's not like just for fun, for relaxation. But yeah, no, I went to the College of Fine Arts, but I liked math and science. So I was like the only student in the College of Fine Arts that continued taking math classes by choice going into college. And then I was like, I got to learn this thing called programming, because everybody's talking about programming at Carnegie Mellon. And I didn't even understand when they said programming languages. I was like, what does that mean? It's like, sounds so abstract. And so I took like a C++ class. I started taking, at that point, like classes in Flash and Director, like all these things that mix together art and science. But I didn't like any of it. It all felt like it was like a mushing together, where like, I think you were hinting at it, but like engineering and computer science is a very dominant field. It was like overarching a very specific personality at Carnegie Mellon.
Yes.
And then artists, totally different, right? Like, you know what artists, normal artists are like, they could not be more polarized. And here I was trying to like fit into both, and I fit neither persona. And so I really didn't find my place. I couldn't find my calling until my senior year when I took virtual reality class. And virtual reality for me was like, aha, this place where art and science are equal.
Totally. It's a complete marriage.
Yeah.
I mean, you even think about people that are artists that have gone after making animation.
Yes.
You know, I mean, it's, if you don't understand how to code and math and science, and then you have this artistic mind, you cannot do that stuff.
Exactly. And it's really the reliance on the other partner, right? Because like, there's no one person who can build a video game or an animation, like a Pixar animation or a VR experience. Like, you need a programmer and you need artists and you need storytellers, and each one brings their unique experience. But each of the individuals, if they tried to do it alone, they would fail. And I think for me, I was like, that is the world that I like love. The one where it truly, like, the interdisciplinary is not like a statement for a statement's sake, right? It's like, no, you need these brains. And the whole thing comes together only because of these brains.
And did you see in those classes less women, more women, or did you not care?
Yeah, there were way more women, actually. So what was cool is I took it as an undergrad. It's a graduate level course. But I think because of the artistic, storytelling, creative, graphic nature, well, so Carnegie Mellon, I should say, actually, they were one of the first computer science engineering schools that hit 50% this last, I think, 2 years ago. So they've already been very forward thinking and attracting women, and they're the top in the country. So they've achieved both of those things together. But I do think that there was something about virtual reality and graphics that attracted more women into the field. And so our class, when I took it, was, I want to say, close to 50-50 women and men.
Which just makes a big difference.
Yes, it was huge.
Yeah. And then, so when did you start SimOps? Like, was that in school, or did you graduate and go, I'm not going back to Baltimore, but I'm going to go, you know, move into this Silicon Valley where like all the tech stuff is happening?
Yeah, no, I think you'll appreciate this. I was going to New York every summer during college, and I was interning for a modern master art gallery, and I was like loving it. I was like, this is my future. I'm going to come run an art gallery and I'm going to paint on the side. And I'm just going to be sad that this like math and science part of my brain just like isn't getting fulfilled. And then I took that course that fall of my senior year, and I was like, oh my God, I don't know what this is, but it's the future. It's VR, 3D technology. And it just like everything in me came alive. And so I applied to the graduate school 2 days before the deadline that fall semester, and thankfully got in. So I went to the graduate program there for 2 years. And then I had no idea what I was going to do. I was just like, I love this. I don't know what this is, but I love this. And most people were going into games. I interned at EA. I worked on The Sims 2. And I was like, that's cool, but it's
not quite.
Oh, it was so fun. It was
so great. I mean, you know, my kids were Sims kids.
Yes. Yeah, totally.
You know? And on a cold weekend, you know, they could start, Jessica would get into it, and then Emily and Josh eventually, and they'd all be sitting around the computer, like the one where you figure out the whole carnival and how do you make money and how do you keep everyone alive and hoping. And I just thought it was such a great learning experiences, and depending on which one excited you.
Yeah. So when I was working on the Sims 2, it was cool because, I mean, obviously very influential to Modsy and where we are, but it was the people-driven simulation. And it was like, you built houses, you built communities, you like had your characters. but they had enough AI in there that the Sims themselves had their own thing going on. And so my job was one to QC and like make sure things were working. And then I also got into the video department and I helped them make some of the first like video ads that were going to market the Sims. But I literally fought them. Like I'd have to fight against the Sims to get them to do what I wanted them to do so I could screen cap what was going on. And I was like, this is so interesting. I'm like, we are building this computer program, but yet I'm sitting here like fighting against this computer that's not necessarily doing what I need it to do at the moment.
That's hilarious. And so then did you have in your head this idea of the startup you wanted to do, why you were there, seeing things that were perhaps voids in the Sims marketplace?
You know, I think I liked it. I didn't have an idea for him. I just knew that there was just something really special about, like, again, the combination of the graphics, the programming that gave the Sims their life of their own, this ability to create this simulated world. But no, I was really far from having an idea at that point. I went back to my second year in graduate school, was working on a project, and that's what became my first company. It was not my intention to start up the company at all out of school. I had no entrepreneurial background, no business background. Really, like, I thought that was like kind of going to the dark side, is going into the business world. So, but we worked on taking game technology. We worked with actually the New York Fire Department, and we were doing training simulations post 9/11 to help firefighters really experience a lot of the unknown, like either hazardous materials or terrorist situations. Cool. It was really cool. It was, I mean, and that was when I was like, okay, like, I don't know what the business model is exactly, but this thing we're building, we had fire departments all over the world on our wait list. I was like, this is a need in the market. So I couldn't imagine just like putting it on a shelf and saying like, forget it, we're not going to bring this to market. And I'm going to go work it like on a game. I'm going to like, I need to go make this happen. So that is what led me. A professor actually said, well, why don't you start a company? And like, he literally loaned me $10,000. So that was it. Then we started the business and got to work.
That's amazing. And you eventually sold it to Google, right?
No, to Autodesk. Yeah.
That's right.
And that was, I mean, my first business lesson, which is just because it's a big need in the world doesn't mean that they have money to pay.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's a whole other story. But what's interesting is you ended up going into venture for a while.
Yes.
And we see that more in men than we do in women. You know, yeah. We see someone who's like, I sold my company and now I'm a venture capitalist, you know, or I was number four at Facebook. I have so much money and I'm going to be a venture capitalist.
Yeah.
And, you know, talk about what it was like being a female in then, even though it wasn't that long ago, a very predominantly male world in venture, which also probably kind of gave you handcuffs because at the end of the day, you went back and started another company.
Yes, absolutely. Well, so another woman you might know, Lindsay Ullman, was one of the people who kind of recruited me in. And then basically day one I started, she was like, and I'm leaving. And she was the only other woman on the investment team there. So I was like, okay, well, I didn't know I was signing up to be the only female on this team. I mean, it's definitely like, I think in any career where you walk into a room and you're the only person like you, it's intimidating and it makes you feel like your thought process is wrong. So there were things that either I liked or I was interested in, subject matters, companies, profiles of entrepreneurs, that just didn't resonate with the partnership. And none of it was like overt. I think it was just subconscious, like, no, that's not really interesting to us, right? And you hear that all the time in venture capital. That's like an appropriate response, like, eh, not really interested in that, right? But layered within that, I think, is like many, many layers of the difference of thinking, the difference of thought processes, the biases, et cetera. And so I think it was hard for me to find my footing because I was like, I'm sort of interested in where the physical world meets the virtual world, the digital world, like where does services happen in the world that are informed by mobile technologies and online technologies, especially consumer services. But a lot of them were actually female facing kinds of services. And so it definitely felt a little bit like an uphill battle, but I felt like I got my grounding over the course of a year and we did some incredible investments. Like the last one I helped lead before I left was Jet, which takes it in for $1 billion later. So
that was a good
it was good. But I think, you know, for me, the vantage point of seeing as an entrepreneur, all of these companies and Google Ventures at that point being 5 years old. So they had done a lot of investments that were maturing. And they were still trying to kind of figure out, are we early stage, late stage, everything. So they were investing across the board.
Yeah, they really have
a lot of changes. Yeah.
There's been a lot of changes through Google Ventures for sure.
So I entered right at that point that it was all messy, which actually was like the best place to learn, right? We were seeing 100 seed investments mature while we were also, you know, we'd led the investment in Uber like 2 weeks after I joined. And so the spread was incredible. And then you can see sort of businesses that are late stage and how they're evaluated, businesses that are early stage. Who are the entrepreneurs that are really standing out and what are they doing? And so I loved that experience, but I am like an operator through and through. So as I thought about this, I really kind of faced the problem as a customer, but I thought about the idea for Modzy. I could not put it aside, even though I was actually starting to really enjoy investing.
And what was that little nugget that started to just grow and grow and grow when it started thinking about Modzy? I mean, I remember talking to you from early on. I was like, this makes so much sense and nobody is doing this because as particularly millennials move from place to place to place, is that they're doing it themselves. You know, it was like only like 15% of people, or if not 10, hire decorators.
Less than that, I think. Yeah. I
mean, 90% of people do it by themselves.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, it's a huge need. I mean, and I obviously am that customer. So my husband and I, we moved into an apartment in San Francisco and I went to go buy furniture and I was like, immediately stuck. I went to Pinterest. I made a board. I was like looking at these beautiful images. And I was like, I don't know. Those don't look anything like my actual room and the scale, the measurements, like, you know, the aesthetic of the structure, the architecture is totally different. And so I couldn't make a single decision because they're all so interrelated. Like if you make a decision on the sofa and then the art and the rug and the layout of the space, it all has to work together. And for me, it was like, aha, like this is a visual problem. And I've spent my entire career thinking about visual problems and 3D problems. And so I think that was maybe what was unique is I'm sure me, like, you know, millions of people had that problem. This is really hard. This could be a better process.
Yeah. And, you know, when you did start to go out and raise money for Modzy, even though, you know, people knew you in the industry, you had a very successful woman in a predominantly male oriented town, it was really hard for people to sort of grasp what you were doing. I mean, you know, listen, I'm an investor in you. And I remember like sending to certain people and they were like,
don't get it.
Did not even get it. And I, that could have been the beginnings of when I was like, what is wrong with all these venture capitalists? Like, how do they not get it? They're supposed to be paying attention to what's going on in the world.
Totally. No, it's true. I mean, our customer is 70% female, age 30 to 55, 100K plus household income. That is not the profile of a venture capitalist for the most part. Mm-hmm. And so I think that intuitively getting what we were doing, especially before we had built the product and had customers, is hard. Like today we're a late stage business and somebody can open our financials and be like, okay, they have a business.
Right.
Right. But like at the beginning, you know, you saw it, it was a deck. Here's the visualization. Isn't that amazing? And like mostly women investors, they were like, oh yeah, that is amazing. This is a missing piece of the puzzle. And like my first kind of yeses were all people who knew me, saw that deck and they were like, I'm in.
Totally. I mean, yes, to me it was like, duh, we should have this, right? I mean, I remember talking to someone who's like, well, so I don't really get it. Do you buy what they tell you at like restoration hardware, you know? And I was like, oh my God, you should not be investing in this business.
Exactly. Oh yeah. I mean, we had that through multiple rounds. Like I still remember maybe starting our Series B, people who would look at our kind of core conversion metric, which is the customers who get the designs and then buy the furniture. And they're like, I just don't believe this is going to go up, probably not even like a percent or two. And meanwhile, we've tripled it in the last 3 years.
Right. And COVID certainly has changed, I would assume, everything. I mean, yeah. You closed a huge amount of financing right before COVID hit the ground. You know, how has that been in terms of your company? And also, we have seen, as you know, so many companies that were on the cutting edge of technology that we, as investors or people that are pulse on the technology industry, said, well, eventually this is going to work because we're going there. And COVID literally put a backpack and put a rocket on it and like, boom, all these companies went off. So what happened to Modzy during this time is everyone has become like a house potato.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that it's sort of tale of two stories for us. We didn't know the prior recessions the industry around furniture and decor was hit really hard. So the prior two recessions, it was a 30% reduction in the industry. So we, in April, like so many other companies, were like, oh my God, we're headed into recession. The bottom's going to fall out. Like, let's just conserve capital and watch the behavior of consumers and make sure that we survive through this. Mm-hmm. And so we cut back some of our expenses. We stopped all of our marketing. We did all of this stuff getting ready for like the storm.
The big one, right.
And then May came and then June came and we're like, huh, our sales haven't changed. And we have literally, our marketing budget is a tenth of what it was at the beginning of this. So what's going on here? And so by June and July, it was very obvious. And now in hindsight, that if you lock people in their house, they spend a lot of time doing house projects. Yeah. And the home becomes very, very important. So yeah, the home category has done really well. We were able to take this time, I think, two different things. Like one, obviously the business has strength in the category, but like you said, it's long-term transformation. People who were already moving to online kind of got fully pushed to online commerce as the stores closed. I think service providers, the idea of bringing a designer into your house was like a no-go, still is a no-go. So people who maybe were considering hiring a designer moved to online design. And then lots of people who were like, I suddenly have time for projects and my house is pretty important to me, which I think is a long-term kind of renewed investment in the house because the house has been our sanctuary this year. So all of those things are really amazing tailwinds. But I think for us, we also said, what are we going to do to invest in the core foundation of the business? Because this is like a once in a lifetime opportunity at a later stage scaling company to pause and fix everything that was breaking during the prior 3 years of just like crazy fast growth. And so we did that. We like changed some fundamental structures in our data. We changed our designer model. We removed our lowest price package actually in August. So we took some really bold moves that normally you don't have like the air cover to do because you're just moving so fast as a business. So this year has been incredible for us.
That's amazing. So you're really at a higher level with less human beings.
We are less human beings and just like a lot more control, right? Like, I think that's the biggest feeling I have as an entrepreneur is like when you're moving at the pace we were moving and, you know, you're growing and things are breaking around you, you're just like holding onto the tail and you're hoping that it all stays together and it doesn't just like come apart into pieces. And we had that like once in a lifetime opportunity to say, okay, let's fix some of the like foundations here such that as we now have started growing again, it just doesn't feel quite as like chaotic and wild, which is also true in the culture, right? Like you get that feeling in the culture where you start losing some of the things that are special. And so we got to regroup during COVID in a really meaningful way.
Do you see your company going back to an office at any point? Like, where do you see this going? I mean, you've been extremely successful and productive during this time period, you know, certainly being on Zoom all day long. I mean, I spoke to a bunch of people yesterday and was like, Zoom number 38. Yeah. And totally. So what do you think is the future of work in regards to your company?
Yeah. So what's interesting is I feel like we were already on this path pre-COVID. So we were 60% virtual, remote, work from home. Mm-hmm. And we had this office in San Francisco where of the, I think at that point, about 150 plus people who worked at the company, there were supposedly 50 people in San Francisco office. And really every day there were 20 to 30 people in the office, except for like key days. And so we were sort of headed to this very virtualized, very flexible, but we hadn't fully embraced it. So we had this beautiful office, but it just kind of looked sad some days where you're like, there's only 10 people here. Like, where are all the people? Why do we have this office?
Right. Why are we paying rent?
Exactly. Exactly. So yeah, so I think this just, again, like shoved us into the future of where we're headed anyway. It immediately leveled the playing field. So my favorite part about it was everybody who's virtual, including like an incredibly talented VP of engineering who's in Seattle, right? Like my connection to her is no different than the VP of marketing, say, that's in our San Francisco office, right? And so it's a very even playing field right now that I don't want to lose. So I imagine San Francisco, Portland, and then Bulgaria. Those are the places where we have actual physical offices or had actual physical offices. We don't have one in Portland anymore. I can imagine we would put in place like a hub. And so the future would be more like on key meeting days, maybe people aggregate there. There's hotel desks for days that people want to come and just get away from their house and be in a social environment, but that it's not a permanent desk structure, work from the office mentality, because that wasn't working for us anyway.
Right. And you know, the one thing that I love is like you had a child through all this.
Yes. Yes. 2.5 years old. So yes. Squarely in the middle of Modzy, I had my first.
Squarely right in the middle. The company's 5 years old. So right there in the middle. And how has that changed you as a founder and a CEO?
I mean, first of all, just being a mom is like the best thing that ever happened to me in my whole life. So I think on one hand, it's just like there's something way more important than everything else in the world now. And that wasn't true. So yeah, work is second. And I think that work being second was really healthy too, because I'm able to take space from Modzy in a way that I couldn't for the first 2.5 years. And then it is like the ultimate, you have to get your time organized, right? Like jumpstart in your life, right? So it was like, I have to get there at 9 and I have to leave at 5 because we have a nanny. And like, there is going to be nobody to hold that kid and feed that kid if I'm not home at 5, right? So I would be in the office easily till 7:30 the year before. And so my hours got so much more focused. I was so much more productive, but I also was like, you know, I started saying no to things that were just low value that I used to say yes to.
Well, that's a really interesting point, right? Because I've seen so many female founders who, I mean, it is what it is, that it's like, you're not going to wait till 50, or everything sort of happens in that time period of your life.
Yeah.
And they've had children. Some have had multiple children.
Yeah.
And they've become better founders and better leaders because they're not obsessed with the low-hanging fruit nonsense. They're very focused. They're very organized. And they have something else in their life, which, you know, I've always been the big believer, family first, and all the rest falls into place.
Absolutely. And that perspective, I think, is healthy because it's so hard to be an entrepreneur, right? Like your day is constantly disrupted with like, high, low, high, low. And so to be able to step back and be like, at the end of the day, this is a business and I am my own person and I have my own life. And there's something, again, like that's bigger than it all for me. It just helps you manage that high and low roller coaster from an emotional standpoint in such a better way, such a healthier way.
And, you know, you are in San Francisco. So what have you done as this woman who is very influential in the tech world to help support and uplift other women? I mean, I don't know how you feel about this, and I want you to talk about this, is there has been such a change over the past 13, 14 years. And who says that? Is it Bill Gates? Like one day, you know, nothing happens, but over a decade, a lot can happen. I saw some data this morning about how more women are staying home through this and walking away from their careers. And that is very concerning to me. And, you know, what do you do to sort of help these women stick in there and like keep going?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I will mentor or take a call with or look at the deck of anybody that comes my way. That's an early stage founder, but certainly primarily women. And I would say primarily women seek me out. So, I mean, you know, my admin who helps me, like she knows that anytime one of these comes through, like I'm going to make space and I'm going to make time, because that's what people did for me. Like my early mentors, they took me under their wing. They never said, I'm too busy for you. And they made connections and they helped me kind of take that leap forward. So I'm always taking those calls. I'm always getting those emails. I'm always like helping make introductions. I think I even send a bunch of them your way.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. This morning, someone hit me up on Instagram and just asked some questions about how do they go about deciding what their valuation is or what percentage of their company should sell. And like, I totally answered, because, you know, these are the questions that everyone grapples with. But if you've been in it, you know the answers.
Exactly. Yeah. I literally just at the end of last week had a call with an early stage founder. She's got term sheets coming together. She's, you know, trying to think about who to let into the round, how many, it's a seed round. So like how many seed stage funds? And I was like, okay, let me tell you what I've found valuable. Like 5-6 years in, how many funds, what size funds, how many individuals, who's really there late in the game and still adding value.
Yeah. I mean, there's just unfortunately a lot of people that they have the money and their brand is bigger than their actual participation as a human being getting involved and helping you make decisions. And that to me is what a real good investor does.
Absolutely. I said exactly that. I was like, I was surprised who 5 years later, right, that's adding value, that's taking my call, that's helping me think through problems versus who I thought was going to be there 5-6 years later and is like, like MIA.
It is a very interesting world. So I just want to wrap up, and I'm curious, what are your insights about the future of what mixed reality and retail looks like, right? I mean, I've always been obsessed with retail. I think that there's been a lot of bad business models and that needs to change. And you know, you're in a completely online visual world, yet people are buying physical things through your site that they're going to sit their tush on. And so, you know, where do you think this is all going?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think you're right in that there's something about the physical that is never going to leave, right? And I think that what we've learned in the virtual space is that there's a few things people are seeking out, certain product categories you want to touch, you want to feel. For us, you know, we sell in a room 30 items on average. You probably don't need to touch all 30 items, like the lamp you're not touching, the desk you're not touching, but the chair, the bed, the sofa, for sure. So I think there is the experience of going into stores that people will always want. But I do think that for many stores, you need to think of them as showrooms, that people are not there to make the purchase. They're going to go home and weigh the decision. They're going to use tools like what we've provided so they can try different options. They can narrow it down. I think the other big learning, though, is that, I mean, especially this year, like we are craving social connection.
So badly. So,
being in a space with people, like making a space social, whether that's, again, like a coffee shop that's embedded within a store, or whether that is a service provider where you get to meet them in person. And so much of what we're doing right now, even though it's virtual, people just want somebody to talk to. And they want somebody who's like helping them have hope and have a like fun project and have a distraction. And like, those are the kinds of things we hear that then ultimately improves their lives. But that personal connection is something that people, I think, will always be craving, and that there's an in-person component that's really hard to replace.
Yeah. I just don't see them ever going away. I mean, people need to get out of their house. And I think that's one of the reasons, as you know, in the art world over the last couple of years, as technology has exploded, more people are going to museums, more people are going to galleries, more people are going to art shows, more people are going to theater, just because it's a communal event.
Exactly. And I think that's going to be the distinction. I think if you're creating a physical space, you need to think about what's the purpose of it. A lot of it's about the kind of interaction, the human component of it, and or a physical interaction with something that's really hard to glean online. And then I think everything else is digital. Like, expect that person to come in with like their digital wallet, their digital inspiration, having done their research, maybe going home and doing the transaction, right? And so that hybrid is going to be the way that we're all living.
Yeah, walking around with bags is not going to happen.
No.
I mean, there's just no reason for it to happen.
Especially when, you know, in our category, the items are not even things you can like walk out with, right? If it's like a giant mirror, you're not preferring to walk out the door with that.
Absolutely not. And you want to get on your Modsy room and make sure that it's going to fit exactly where you want it to fit.
Yep. And you probably show your spouse, maybe do some price research, right? Like, you're going to, people are very savvy.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming on. This is great. I always love talking to you.
Yes, this is wonderful. Have a great day.
To learn more about Modsy, you can visit the website at www.modsy, that's modsy.com. Our next guest on Positively Gotham Gal will be Frances Brenet, the architect, interdisciplinary artist, and most important, driven educator, who currently serves as the president of Pratt Institute.